Welcome back to the Sweat Elite podcast and welcome back to another episode of The Action. It's Alex and Matt here recapping the events that took place in the running world last week. Alex, thanks for joining. What happened last week in the running world?
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here. Another week, another episode of The Action. We got a good one today recapping and looking forward to what's happening over the weekend. Josh Kerr and the last weekend, Josh Kerr and the Brooks Beasts were up to some action in Oregon. New Zealand announced their team. Michael Johnson got some investment money, some doping scandals, as well as a London Marathon recap, a G-Men Diamond League recap, and looking forward to next weekend, we'll have the Shanghai Diamond League.
Nice. Plenty of action taking place now, and you can really feel like things are heating up towards the season that is the Olympic Games season, you could say, leading into the Olympics that are happening in the first week of August. So we'll touch on plenty of that. But before we go on, just want to thank the sponsor of The Action, which is Pillar Performance. I've been taking Pillar Performance for probably almost 18 months now, pretty much every day, the triple magnesium powder, and recently discovered the fish oil omega-3, which I've been enjoying taking every morning as well, for heart health and mental health as well. And yeah, huge thank you to Pillar Performance that have sponsored this series from about 6 weeks ago now. You can score 15% off by going to Pillar Performance's website and using the code SWEAT15 or going to the feed. If you are an American resident, you can order from the feed with the same discount code SWEAT15. So huge thank you to Pillar Performance for sponsoring The Action. Alex, you mentioned firstly that there was some action going on over in Oregon from Josh Kerr and the Brooks Beast. It looks like Josh Kerr opened up his season, well, at least outdoor season, with a 145, 800 meters. We're both 800 meter guys, at least I used to be, and you currently are. So yeah, let's talk about his time. I watched the video of it. It looked like he was mostly solo. But yeah, what did you think about the performance from Josh Kerr? Probably the man to beat this year in the 1500 meters. Him and Jakob are obviously going to have a showdown.
Yeah, I thought it was a strong opening for him, 145.9. I think he split 52 through his first 400 meters. I think it was just like spinning the legs for him, breaking up training. He loves to do these off main distances races. So indoors, he'll run the 3K and the 2 mile. He'll open up the outdoor season with the 800 and then slowly specify his training into the 1500 meters. I mean, it worked for him last year. I think he's just following the same blueprint this year.
Yeah. Hey, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Josh Kerr normally does an 800 every year. You know, he does a 5K outdoor every year, and then he does like a specific amount of races leading up to like the key event. Am I thinking that I read that correctly a couple of years back?
Yeah, he's definitely done the 800 and 5K outdoors before specifying to the 1500. Danny Mackey, I think, has him just on the same training plan every year, and I think they've just slowly gotten better, and obviously he's become the world champion, so I don't think he's trying to change too much of what he's of the formula that's worked.
Yeah. I've always thought to myself, Josh Kerr, I would love to see one day Jakob, Josh Kerr, all these 1500 meter guys, Ollie Hall, they all race over an 800 meters. I think that'd be really interesting, especially if they had a pacer going through pretty quick, like 50 high, 51 low, to set them up to potentially go 143. Because like you pointed out that Josh Kerr's first lap was 52. Now, if that's correct, I think I remember seeing that. Pretty hard to run even 144 off 52. Like we both know that, and anyone that's run the 800 meters or paid attention to the splits, it's pretty hard to even split an 800, let alone negative split. I mean, the 1500 meters and the 5K and everything above, well, more specifically, 1500 meters through to 10K, you'll almost always see a very fast last lap. Whereas in the 800 is different. You'll almost never see a second lap that's faster than the first, unless the first lap is like super slow. So yeah, to go out in 52, very hard to even sort of break 145, but yeah, to run 145, doesn't really surprise me. It's sort of just a bit of a result that's sort of you'd expect from him, especially off that pace. But I think it does leave people wondering, like, what could he run if he was given the opportunity to run as fast as he could and go through in 50 high? And, you know, who knows? People speculate often, like, what could Jakob run over 800? What do you think he could run over 800 if he was put into a Diamond League that was going out in, like, 51 flat?
Running 143. I mean, 143 is like a 50 and then a 52. Given like the point, whatever, 0.5, like I just can't see him doing that. I don't know. I feel like his training, especially Jakob talks about his training, he trains over 100 miles a week. The 800s just, you need more like explosiveness, legs popping, more of that strength, like muscular strength rather than like aerobic strength. So I would see, his official PR is 146 now because he barely races 800, but I could see him going 144 high.
Yeah, same. I'd find it hard to believe he'd break 144 and a half. Yeah, if I had to pick, I'd say 144 high, 145 low. Yeah, Kerr, I think probably would go a little bit quicker, but then, you know, I think most people would know that once you go sort of above 1500 meters and especially up towards 5K, I think Jakob would be very, very, very much the favorite if they both race each other over those distances. But yeah, good result. Probably not really surprising to anyone seeing that time or that result. Yeah, I mean, he did win, which is a big deal to point out too. I mean, if he was beaten, it probably would have been a little bit disappointing, right? But yeah, he won pretty convincingly. So yeah. And at the same meet, I believe, the Brooks Beast set the DMR world record, which some could argue is, well, look, I mean, looking at the splits, it's a fast time, right? Like they've gone 9:14, which consisted of Brandon Kidder starting off in 2:49 for the 1200. Brendan Miller, who is an 800 meter guy, 46.6 in the 400 meter leg. Isaiah Harris running 145.75 split in the 800, and then Henry Winn finishing off in 3:52.64. So looking at all those splits individually, they all kind of look like solid results from each individual, but no real standout splits. I'm not clear if Henry Winn has run quicker than that over a mile. I think his mile best is around that. And yeah, the other times are probably what you would expect. But I think some people do point out that this race isn't run super often, but even still, like a world record to go down and yeah, super quick time, super quick splits. But yeah, you pointed out beforehand off air that like, how often is this really run? You pay attention actually to the US scene quite a bit more than I do. I'm sort of trying to pay attention to the whole area, but probably actually watch European stuff a little bit more. But how often do people go after this sort of world record in your opinion? Is it common?
No, I don't think it's common at all. And I think running this world record at this time is actually pretty interesting because the world relays for world athletics are coming up at the beginning of the month. I'm pretty sure it's in the Bahamas. Could be wrong, but there's no distance relays at that meet. It's 4x1, 4x4, and I think maybe another sprint relay. But there's never any distance relays at these bigger relay meets. I just think they should bring them back. I think World Athletics did have them originally, but after Kenya and the U.S. and other European nations would not send teams for the distance relays, then they just scratched it. So I don't think it's, and then inside of the U.S., it's not really contested that often. College is contested the most, I would say. I was telling you before that University of Oregon, University of Mississippi ran like 9:19 indoors, I'm pretty sure, at the national meet to set the indoor world record. So it's mostly contested by college kids, and the NCAA system is very strong. So 9:19 is a very strong time. But a professional team easily, as you saw, took that time, took 9:19 to shreds. I mean, 9:19 was indoors, but any professional team like the Brooks Beast or even Bowerman in their golden age would, if they contested it officially, contested DMR, would rip that time.
Yeah, I would looking at those splits individually, you'd think that they could, I mean, this is a bold statement, I'm aware, but like you probably could take 4 to 5 seconds off that with a professional team in basically taking off one to two seconds from every single one of those legs. I know it sounds easy for me to say, but yeah, I mean, I can already think of a couple of teams that could probably do that relatively quickly, except for the 400 meter leg, right? Because those teams don't tend to have 400 meter guys. But that 400 meter split was 46.6, which you pointed out off air is not a super quick 400 split, but that is, he is not a 400 meter runner. He's an 800 meter runner. So that's actually a pretty good split individually for him. Yeah, interesting. There was plenty of sharing of that on Instagram. My Instagram feed blew up for half a day about the DMR world record. And I was like, being Australian, I was like, what's DMR again? Oh, that's right. It's the distance medley relay. Which, you know, I obviously was familiar with, but temporarily I actually forgot what that was, because outside the States, it's just not raced. So yeah, world record, really good result nonetheless. But yeah, in your intro, you pointed out that New Zealand announced their team already for the distance, at least for the males, for the Olympics, George Beamish. was announced in the 3K steeple, and Sam Tanner in the 1500. So probably no surprises there. What do you think about the announcement? I have a thought about Beamish.
Yeah, I think they announced a preliminary team, 15 males and females combined. I think it was all the people that are just kind of dominant in their field. So I think Hamish Kerr was announced in the high jump as well. So all the people that are global, just names that have already hit the standard. New Zealand, I guess, wanted to make an announcement and make sure that they don't want to hold off anymore. And I don't think they hold an official trial. So this was their way of kind of rewarding the stars before their last, however many people qualify.
So I was wondering, Geordie Beamish, given he won World Indoors 1500 meters, why he wasn't announced in the 1500 meters as well. And then you pointed out very quickly, I don't think he has the standard, which is true, the automatic standard. How the points work, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I assume he got a fair few points from winning World Indoors, but I haven't gone back and done the looking at where his points lie. But we did have a look at the schedule at the Paris Olympic Games and wondered if he could be added to the 1500 meter field later and what that would mean if he did. Like, could he actually do that? Because, yeah, let's not forget the fact that only, what, a little bit over a month ago, he won the World Indoor 1500 meters in a kind of a strong field. Like, there was obviously some people missing, some very key players, very key, but to win in a field that was still pretty strong is not to be forgotten. But I mean, we took a look at it and I sort of pointed out that it's pretty tough to do that double 3K steeple because the heats of the 1500 meters are on day two. And then there's a day off, and then there's the 1500 meter semi, and then there's a day off for the 1500 meters, and then the 1500 meter final. But in that day off between the semi and the final, there's the 3K steeple first round. So theoretically, you could do this, but if you made the final of the 1500 meters, you would have to then run, or he would have to decide, do I do the 1500 meter final fresh, or as, you know, as fresh as everyone else in the field, and forget the steeple chase? Or do I do the steeplechase first round and then have to deal with the fact that I'm going into the final somewhat fatigued? And then I believe there was 2 days until the final. No, I think there was only 1 day, I think, until the steeple final. So yeah, tough to try and pull it off. Be interesting to see if he does. I think I doubt that will happen, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see because it does leave the choice open if you did do the semifinal to choose. But yeah, I can't see that happening. And yeah, like I said, Sam Tanner was selected in the 1500 meters. He was a finalist at the last major championship. So he, I actually met up with him and a couple of triathletes, Hayden Wild in Andorra last year, and had a bit of a chat to him. And yeah, great guy. Obviously, I only spoke to him for about half an hour, but it'd be good to see how he goes this year. Next bit of news you pointed out was something that's been in the background for a little while and is still a little bit mysterious, but you can intro this one. There's lots of hype, but I don't really know. We haven't really found out much more information yet.
Sure, a couple weeks ago, I would say, a couple months ago, maybe.
It's a couple of months.
A couple months ago, former American track star Michael Johnson partnered with a company called Winners Alliance, and they want to put together a track league starting in 2025. And they recently announced this week that they just. I don't know if it's their first round of investment or their total investment for starting in 2025, but they announced $30 million worth of investment to get this track and field league started.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you've put on our notes here. You think that's a little bit low, and I totally agree. I mean, if you really think about the amount, I mean, neither of us can really speak to how much it would cost to pull one of these things off. We can have a guess, we can speculate, but I would have thought based on I remember this news, and we spoke about this together roughly a couple of months back. And I remember thinking to myself that you'd need $100 to $200 million to make this a really serious thing. That was just our guess, and yeah, like full, yeah, very much a guess. that $30 million does seem a little bit low because, yeah, these events are really, really, really difficult to pull off. Lots of things to think about in terms of staffing. Lots of things to think about in terms of marketing, in terms of incentives to bring athletes there, in terms of media around it, in terms of broadcasting the actual event. In fact, I think that's one of the most difficult parts. Like, where do you actually broadcast this? And there was some interesting news last week around the Diamond League going to an interesting place. And there's a bunch of smaller meets around the US that have also had a hard time figuring out how to broadcast this, because the reality is, going slightly off topic but still aligned with this topic, is that like people don't want to pay to view content, and they also don't really like to see a lot of ads or really any ads. And when people complain about both of those things relentlessly, I try and point out the fact that, okay, well, how exactly do you think that this is going to work then? Because these events are super expensive to produce. There's lots of things, lots of moving parts, even hiring stadiums, renting things like that can be really expensive. So yeah, 30 million seems like a low number, but who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking about this at length. I mean, if he wants to put together a league, this means that it's going to be a multi-month project each year with multiple meets. And I think the only way to really incentivize top athletes to come is to pay them a huge purse. I have a huge purse to have them come to the meet to get, if they win, they get X amount of money. That's bigger than the Diamond League, because they're not going to set up the league and then all of a sudden be labeled as a gold standard meet by World Athletics to have a lot of points at their meet. That's not how it works. I think over time, you need to build that up, and you have to have a certain prize purse per meet to get that label of a World Athletics gold meet to have high points, so that people will come for the points as well as coming for the prize money. Because there's no incentive to leave the Diamond League or leave the Continental Tour gold when there's some other random league that's not affiliated with World Athletics. So I don't really know exactly how they're going to go about this. I mean, they're the professionals, and Michael Johnson is heavily involved with World Athletics and was an athlete himself. So I would assume that they know what's going on, but I wonder how they're going to pull it off in terms of getting athletes to their meets over other meets that are already established. Even though people don't love the viewing of the Diamond League or the viewing of the Continental Tour Gold on Flow Track or any of those aspects, right now it's the best thing that these athletes have, and it sets them up to go to the World Championship and go to the Olympic Games, and that's what they want to do. So I'm interested to see how Michael Johnson and the staff around him are able to set this up.
It does mention that he will be sharing full details in June about the league, so that's a couple of months away. But the other thing I wonder, because I've paid attention to the triathlon space for a while, and the triathlon space was really shaken up 3 or 4 years ago when the PTO began, and they've subsequently sort of rebranded to some extent to be the T100 series, even though the PTO, Professional Triathletes Organization, is still the sort of overarching brand. And the question mark that keeps coming up to everyone in the triathlon space is, okay, this is all very expensive to produce, but where is the money coming back? Like there's brand sponsors and so on. But so when I look at this, I think 30 million raised, that's great. But the question in my mind lies, how is that going to be returned? And then there's going to be a profit made on the series. And how is that going to work? So TBA, let's see what Michael Johnson's up to. I mean, you know, neither of us know him personally, obviously, but he seems like a smart dude. You pointed out the fact that he's been involved in the sport heavily for a very long time. He is always in the media rooms doing commentary and so on. So like of all people, he probably has the best shot at making this work, you'd have to think. Like there wouldn't be too many people that would be in a better position to do so. It's worth paying attention to. Still think that this number is a little bit lower than we would have expected, but let's see how this plays out. You might have more investors coming. We don't know. But I do think this is exciting, because the news about the Diamond League moving over to Flow Track, not many people enjoyed that news. I'm not really going to share my opinion about that, because I've got some mixed ones. It obviously is negative, but I don't think I can win with any sort of backing of Flow Track. I don't subscribe to Flow Track. I don't know them. I'm very much neutral with them. Yep, they do great things for the sport. Yep, they're expensive. That sucks. There's definitely some things that I've heard about that, who knows if they're true, but I will say that producing content, I'm sort of repeating myself, producing content and putting these events on is really expensive. It's really hard. And people don't want to pay for it, and they don't want ads. And I don't know, a little part of me thinks, well, it was, I think it was with Eurosport, and even that you had to pay for. And there's the whole argument around, yeah, but if you pay for Eurosport, it was much cheaper and you could also watch other things. I get that. But there was a reason why Eurosport didn't keep it on Eurosport. I mean, do you know what that reason was? I never actually found that out, that reason, but if we don't know what that was, and it obviously wasn't really watched enough. So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting for sure.
I'm not sure with Eurosport, but I mean, I don't want to be negative, but the sad reality is that track and field events aren't heavily watched at a mass level that it's profitable for cable companies to put it on TV. I mean, just, I think last year, the US championships, it could be another track and field event in the US, was moved from NBC for the LPGA Tour. LPGA Tour is the female golf tour. They had some big event, and these golf tours run from Thursday to Sunday, and the track event ran from the US Olympic Trials or the US like national championships is a multi-day event as well. And it was moved from the primetime slot on Sunday because the LPGA Tour had their final round. The LPGA Tour was simply due to numbers. Like, the LPGA Tour had a greater amount of viewers than the U.S. Track and Field Championships. And it's pretty easy for NBC to make a decision that way because it's just numbers. It's not politics. It's just numbers. It comes back down to numbers and how much money they're going to make and telling people that want to put ads on their network how many people are viewing. So I mean, that's just the reality.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's there's no discretion. It's just data, decisions based on data. And so, you know, there clearly wasn't enough interest within Eurosport. I believe Peacock, I mean, it depends where you are in the world, right? Like which where you're watching. But either way, there was a bunch of platforms that had a paywall, and yes, this has made it more expensive to view. People, I don't know, if like, I feel like I am swimming upstream here, because there was a very strong negative vibe around that news. But one thing I'm going to push back on a little bit, and I'm going to be the man standing in the corner with his own opinion, is people often say, oh, I have to pay this much money to watch one race. Okay, well, there is a load of other things behind that paywall. So that's not really true. That's just not true that you have to pay whatever the Flowtrax fee is, $29 a month or whatever it is. That's high. I'm not debating the fact that that's high. That's very high. And I'm not saying that I love this news. But I am just saying that when people say, oh, okay, now I have to pay $29 just to watch one race. Well, not really. Like, there is a lot of other things that would be like, okay, this argument is actually a poor one because Netflix is much cheaper. But it would be like saying, oh, I have to pay Netflix 1 month to watch one show. Well, there's loads of shows there. Okay, bad comparison because Netflix is less than half the cost per month. But you sort of get the point. There is a lot more behind that paywall. A lot of it is good too, because I have subscribed to Flowtrax before. So yeah, I mean, I'll leave it at that. And to be clear, I'm not saying I love the news. I'm just giving a different point of view.
Just moving on from Flowtrax into some doping news. Pierre Boss, who was a 2017 world champion over 800 meters, was banned for 16 months due to a whereabouts failure. I know you had some interesting takes on that, Matt. What was your reaction to the news?
Yeah, so 2017 world champ over the 800 meters. I remember watching that race. He shocked himself a little bit for the win, even though he was up there in many of the Diamond Leagues leading in. I think he probably went into that race thinking he was a medal shot that he won. I looked into this before the recording, and there was Jonathan Galt went through this a little bit and basically dissected the fact that Boss actually had his missed tests between September 2022 and June 2023. So he had three missed tests in that period of time. And he announced his retirement in December 2023. So to be clear, the window of time that he missed the tests were between September 2022 and June 2023. And 6 months after that window closed, he announced his retirement. And when he announced his retirement, he knew he was facing a potential ban, of which at the time would have been 2 years, because that's this typical one if you plead guilty immediately, from what I understand. And so he announced his retirement. And so there's an article in French by L'Equipe, and it basically dives into it in French. And the translated situation was that Pierre basically said, I made three mistakes. I accept it. It is true that I have not always been the best student when it comes to taking care of my location. But until then, it has never played any tricks on me. I know I should have been more serious, but I would like to point out that I have been in the AFLD target group since 2012 and they have all of my analysis. So, yeah. There's not much else really out there about this situation. I think there was a, there's another quote here. At that moment, I gave up completely. Behind, it was a vicious cycle. I was freewheeling without knowing that it was hanging over my nose. I was wandering around a bit here and there. I haven't been too focused on location in recent months. So lots of sort of vague language there, of which doesn't really mean a lot. He's just sort of just saying whatever comes to his mind. But there was a really weird excuse pulled out of this article about he blamed the second mistest on his doorbell not working, which seems a bit lame, but we don't know any more information, so hard to really judge that one, I don't think. But yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I was telling you before, it kind of just, I mean, whereabouts failures are tricky in of themselves just because the athlete wasn't actually popped for doping, but many people just equate whereabouts failures to getting a positive test because you kind of need to because they missed the test for one reason or another. And some people think that that's not fair because they have not tested positive and that if you did give them a test, they would have tested negative. But I think more for me in this scenario, it just makes me think just about 2017, if he was positive or not at that moment. And it's really hard to tell. I mean, he said he was in that French doping control system since 2012, which makes it seem like he was not doping at the time. But once someone gets caught like this at any really moment of their career, there's going to be red flags on their name for kind of forever. It is what it is. I mean, he said he wasn't a good student when it comes to putting his location, but being a good student of the location is really important these days, given all the doping positives. And being a student of running and training is almost equally as important as being a student of updating your location. So, I mean, it's really bad that he tested, like, it's negative that a world champion has this hanging over their head, but we'll never really know about 2017.
Bit of a sad way to go out, obviously, but yeah, like you said, it's really hard to know. It's one of those things, like, yeah, brings up the question of now versus then. It's like, if an athlete does, you brought this up before we hit record, it's like, if an athlete hits their peak and then struggles for a bunch of years with injury, tries to get back to their peak. Let's say this is actually the truth. Let's just say this is the truth. And then he starts to dope. He starts to take performance enhancing drugs, gets tested positive. Like, majority of people would just assume he was doping the whole time. Because if someone's going to cheat at one point, why should we believe that he was not cheating in the first place? But you can also kind of put yourself in their position and be like, oh, I had that and now I want to get back to that. And especially if you start to convince yourself that everyone around you is doing it. I mean, that's the whole Lance Armstrong theory, right? Like, he was convinced his whole career, which he still believes to be true, and it appears Lance Armstrong is right, but, you know, who really knows? All the documentaries out there appear to back him up on this case, is that he was on the understanding that everyone's doping. So the only way to win is to dope as well. And who knows if Pierre was in that headspace? Who knows if this, you know, who knows? I mean, he didn't even test positive, right? It's just missed tests. So just you know, speaking my mind. But yeah, who really knows what happened here? It's a sad way to go out. He was a bit of a legend in France and in Europe for a while there because he was known to be a bit of a party guy as well, which was, you know, it's always entertaining to see guys that are winning world champs and are also having a lot of fun with their life. So he was quite an entertaining character, but yeah, disappointing news and who really knows the truth. But there's some big events coming up, big events in the States. Alex, you pay very close attention to the US scene. There's some big races coming up. What is coming up in the next few weeks before we go over the London Marathon?
I mean, just one event I wanted to point out was the Penn Relays. People in America, high schoolers in America, across the country, everyone knows about the Penn Relays, huge event. They've recently started putting in and incorporating professional events, elite events into the field, into the slate of the schedule. And this year, there's really only one, I would say, marquee pro event, and it's the mile. Oh, wait. So On actually sponsors the Penn Relays this year, and that's why a bunch of the OAC people will be competing there. And the mile includes Ollie Hoare, who's fresh off of a second place finish at Aussie Nationals in the 1500 meter, and Yared Nuguse opening up his campaign after his 2024 campaign after finishing his 2023 outdoor campaign with a 3:43 mile. They're actually getting paced by Jordi Beamish, their teammate. And I would assume that Ollie Hoare and Yared Nuguse will be going for the Olympic standard. I mean, Yared obviously has the Olympic standard of 3:50.4. That's the mile standard. The 1500, you're able to get through the mile as well. So I think the 1500 meter standard is 3:33.5, but that converts to a 3:50.4 full mile. And I'm pretty sure Ollie Hoare, he missed a bunch of last year. I do not think he has the Olympic standard. And so I think he will be gunning for that Olympic standard to lock up his spot on the Australian national team.
Exciting. Yeah, Penn Relays is a massive deal here in the States. Yeah, looking forward to seeing how that plays out, especially in a really strong, you know, race with these guys. Onto the roads. Well, at least temporarily, there's obviously some track news in the Diamond League stuff coming up. But London Marathon, always a big deal, one of the major marathons. You paid attention to it a little bit more closely than I did this year. But the men's race was won by Alexander Munyaro from, he's from Kenya, right?
He is.
It's always disappointing. I mean, sorry to say this, but I had not heard of him before. I mean, if people had heard of him before this, maybe I'm missing something, but yeah, I know that there was a showdown between him and Kenenisa Bekele. And I think there was a strong backing of Bekele throughout that race, especially given that he's, you know, such a legend of the sport and, doesn't hold the 5K and 10K track world records anymore, but he did hold them for a very, very long time before Joshua Cheptegei took them out in 2020 in paced races set up with the lights. So he had everything set up to do so. But yeah, Bekele was just beaten, unfortunately, by Alexander Munyaro. I'm not really clear what that means for him and making the Olympics, because the Kenyan Olympic situation for the marathon is really, really heating up. There is just so many strong runners there, but that's the case every year for them, right? But yeah, Bekele was second in 2:04.15, his best performance for a while, I argue. He's obviously run 2:01 before in Berlin back in 2019. I was actually in that race. It was really cool to see that. And he's really struggled to get back to sort of any sort of 2:01 form since. He's run a string of sort of 2:05, 2:06, 2:08s. So to go 2:04.15 at the age of 41, really impressive. What does this mean, Alex, if you know? Let's just sort of talk about the Olympic teams for Bekele. Do we know what this means for him? I mean, the Ethiopian Olympic team, we haven't really looked into too much, but it would be really awesome to see Bekele and Kipchoge face each other at the Olympics, because that showdown has been of interest to the running world for many years.
Yeah, so just going back to Alexander Munyaro for a second, then I'll move on to Bekele. He got second at Valencia in 2023, at the end of 2023 in December. And so his spot on the Olympic team, I would say at least, is pretty much locked up on the Kenyan team. I mean, winning London in 2:04 and getting second in Valencia in 2:03 is pretty solid. And then moving on to Bekele. Yeah, So Cisse Lema, who won Boston and won Valencia, he definitely has a spot on the team. And a bunch of Ethiopian stars actually dropped out of the London Marathon, such as Tamara Tola, Mosinet Geremu. And Bekele beat them. And Bekele actually beat all the guys besides Cisse Lema, who were inside the top six, because a bunch of Ethiopians were in this race. There's another Ethiopian with the last name Galeta who won the Seville Marathon in 2:03. And so from Tola, Galeta, and Bekele, two of those three guys will fill the last three Ethiopian spots. In my opinion, Bekele should be on that team. He beat Tamaratola in this race because Tamaratola didn't finish. And he put together 204. He actually ran 204 as well in Valencia, but that wasn't as impressive as he was. Valencia always has a stacked race. I don't remember what place he was in Valencia, but I don't think he was top five with a 204, which is pretty crazy to say. Or maybe he was around fifth. But I think he'll end up making the team and the team for Ethiopia, and it'll be his first ever Olympic marathon. He hasn't made the Olympics since 2012, I want to say. Or it could be 2008. I'm not sure. But I'm pretty sure it's one of the two. But he's never ran the marathon at the Olympics. And setting up the clash with Kipchoge at the Olympics, assuming Kipchoge makes the team, which I think he will, even though he's had not the most stellar 2024 or end of 2023, would be something that every running fan has wanted to see for a very, very, very long time.
Absolutely. I do want to point out something interesting, though, is that people are praising Bekele. Okay, this next thing I'm about to say might surprise some people, but some people will already know about this. So people are praising Bekele for running 204 at 41 years old. There's pretty strong rumors that Kipchoge is at least that age in reality. Now, you know, you can look online and see his real age, but I've personally met someone in Kenya that claims, so he now works for Kenyan Anti-Doping Agency, and I met him in a taxi, and he claims to have been to school in the same year as Kipchoge, and that particular individual, when I met him, was 42, and that was last year. So he's now 43. He claims to be the same age as Kipchoge in school. And when I asked him more about it, he said, look, you know, this is not any sort of inside information. I think it's easy to piece this together. It's like before around 2000, the year 2000, give or take a few years, many people born in these countries, in Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, all those areas around there, around Africa, they weren't typically born in hospitals. They were just born in homes. And they didn't really have a very firm understanding of like what date it is. So they lived their earlier years very much without any idea of what year it is. Like they don't record it. And that might sound hard to believe, but let's go back to the early 80s and understand that this is well before computers, before phones, before, you know, especially in Africa, most people wouldn't have a clock. They wouldn't have a watch. It's very different now. You know, people tend to have phones, tend to have laptops, internet. But this is well before even the internet became more ubiquitous, which was sort of around the early 90s. And some would even argue that it was really truly ubiquitous at the end of the 90s. So in the 80s, there was a lot of not really clear birthdays happening. And why this is where this becomes a potential issue, this is getting a little bit away from this point, but World Juniors is where this becomes a bit of an issue, because many Africans just claim that they're 19 to compete in World Juniors to try and get a contract with a brand, when in reality they're like 23 or 24 or 25, but they don't actually really know how old they are. Now, this doesn't really happen so much anymore because of the technology advancements, right? Like ability to track these things and hospitals becoming better and better. But yeah, the point is, I reckon Kipchoge is a bit older than what he is online. Who knows how much older. The guy I met last year in Kenya could be right. He could be 43, but he did run very, very quick 5K when he was quote unquote 19. So yeah, who knows?
Actually, I agree with you, Matt, on the fact that Kipchoge is a little bit older. They released the date that he graduated high school, and that day, if you match it up with his current birthday online now, would say that he graduated high school and he was 15 years old. So either Kipchoge is not just a genius on the roads, he's also a genius in the classroom and graduated 3 years early from high school, or he's around 3 years older than his actual birthday online.
Who knows how old Kipchoge really is? I mean, does it really matter at this point? Probably not. I mean, you know, once you pass the junior ranks, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's all the same. But I do think it's funny that people are praising Bekele. And let's also not skip over the fact that Bekele may be older than 41. We don't know. Like, who knows? We haven't really looked into that, if there's a real clear birthday there. But I don't think it'll even be on the internet, right? Like, you'll just see birthdays written and you're like, okay, well, is there, like, you need to see a birth certificate. So we're obviously not going to go down that path. But we hope to see Kipchoge versus Bekele at the Olympics. That would be really cool.
Yeah, I mean, so far, they've over the marathon distance at least, They've raced four times, and Kipchoge has won all four times. One of the times, Bekele dropped out of the race in Berlin 2017. But what's very important is that all these times have been before 2019. And what's important about 2019 is that Bekele ran 201.41 in 2019 in Berlin. And so since before that, his personal best was 203 in 2016, but he didn't run any quicker than 205 in 2017 or 208 in 2018. So Bekele's real prominence in the marathon was in 2019. And that in 2019 was also when Kipchoge ran sub 2 in the Ineos Challenge, I'm pretty sure in October of 2019. So that's when those two became like the figures of the marathon and were put head to head comparing each other, Kenya versus Ethiopia, Bekele versus Kipchoge. And so they haven't raced since then. And to do it on the streets of Paris and the Olympics for the first time since 2018 would be amazing.
It will be really, really good. Hopefully we see it happen. There's plenty of potential ifs and whats and whys in the way, but that would be a really great way to see. I would expect one of the two and maybe even both of them to retire after that. Who knows? But I can also speak a little bit to, people may have heard me say this before on a podcast. I don't recall where I said this, but Bekele, so I went to Ethiopia in 2019 with Tate, who has written many of the articles on the Sweat Elite website. And we actually spent some time with one of Bekele's co-coaches. His name is Mersha Azrat. You can look him up. And we spent a bunch of time with him. And at the time, Bekele was not in training. And this actually sort of paints the picture. Ever since Bekele's track days, when he made, you know, a lot of money, he really wanted to be a lot like Haile Gebrselassie. In a sense of, he wanted to use his money wisely, buy businesses, set up a sports complex, purchase hotels, set up restaurants. And when he went down that path in around 2013, 2014, 2015, he bought and started a whole lot of companies with colleagues. And that has become a big passion of his ever since. And it consumes him, from what I understand. Like, it's very, very time consuming. He likes it. He finds it very challenging. But the reason why, according to Mersha, he's struggled to get into shape for a marathon is because of these businesses. Now, that seems hard to really wrap your head around, because you'd think, why can't you get it's easy for me to say, right? I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes with the businesses, but like, you would think he'd be able to get a couple of staff members or a PA to help him in a build-up. But when he ran 201, some people might know this already, but when he ran 201 in 2019, NN running team decided, because they really wanted him to just put a good time on the board, a time that he was capable of, they decided to remove him from Ethiopia and get him to train solely in the Netherlands for 7.5 weeks leading into the Berlin Marathon. And in that time, in only 7.5 weeks, he obviously focused entirely on training. And ultimately went 201. And he's never really been able to do that since. So his training has never really been very consistent leading up to a marathon since. Now, it's really hard to wrap your head around that because of the caliber athlete that he is. And he has the ability to win these world majors, which he has done already at Berlin. But that's what I've been told by Mersha, is that he's really struggled to get motivated to do these training blocks properly. And, you know, looking at it from a zoom right out, he did completely dominate the track in the 3K through to the 10K for a very long time between, I'm going to say 2002, 2003, through until sort of 2010. And so to earn all that money and have so much fame around that time, you can understand why he's sort of then moved on to other things. So yeah, I don't know. It's just an interesting point that some people may not really understand, but it seems like he took this block pretty seriously. He still performed reasonably well. And yeah, really hoping that he gets selected and can take that block seriously too. You'd have to assume that if he gets selected for the Olympics, he'll take that block seriously.
That's actually incredible insight. I've never heard that story before, but that makes complete sense that when he's removed from business, just focus on running, the natural, like, amazing ability that he has kicks in and he ran 201.
Yeah. There were some good results from some other athletes. Alex, I can let you take over here, but some pretty good British results.
Yeah, so coming into the marathon, only one of the British spots only the British Athletics had only chosen one spot for the men's marathon for Paris, and that was Phil Sessman after he ran 208, I think 04 or 06, just under the 208.10 standard in Seville. And so it was basically a time trial or a British, not time trial, a British marathon trials for two spots between Emile Kyrres, Mohamed Mohamed, Mark Scott, Callum Hawkins. And Emile Kyrres and Mohamed Mohamed came on top. Kyrres came in third in 206. Mohamed Mohamed came in fourth overall in 207. They both got the Olympic standard and put on amazing performances. So the British team is set as Kyrres at 206, Mohamed Mohamed at 207, and Phil Sessman at 208.
Strong team. All under the same management group as well. Four-team management. Very impressive to have all three in the same group. And I believe Phil and Sessman and Emile train together. At least they used to train together quite a lot when I was doing some videos with them last year. I think they still do quite a bit.
I think another part of that was really interesting was after the marathon, Emile was getting interviewed about British marathoning and he didn't seem very happy about it. He was asked, like, you guys have made such big improvements, third and fourth in the London Marathon for Brits, hasn't happened in a while. You guys are second and third all time behind Mo Farah. Like, are you happy with your performances? And he was just like, I mean, he was like, no, I'm not. I want to be the best in the world. I want to compete with the best in the world. And 206 is not the best in the world. 206 is not even the best in Europe. And I did some analysis and I was wondering, like, if he was over exaggerating or if he was just being hard on himself, but truthfully he wasn't. Just for some statistics, in Germany, they have three marathoners going to the Olympics. They have a 204 guy in Amanel Petros, 206 guy in Samuel Fitwe, 207 guy in Richard Ringer, and they even have a fourth guy who's been on the Sweat Elite podcast before, Hendrik Pfeiffer, who also ran 207. France has a 203 guy in Amdouni and two 205 guys in Mehdi Frery and Nicolas Navarro. Spain has one 205 guy and two 207 guys. Italy has a 206 guy in Yemen Krippa, two 207 guys. Belgium has a 203 guy in Bashir Abdi, a 206 guy in Cohen Nayert, and a 208 guy in Michael Somers. That's 5 countries that overall have a faster average time than Great Britain over the marathon, and they're all European countries. So, I mean, Emile's right.
Yeah, he is right. I mean, let's not take away the fact that that's a huge personal best, and that's a 206 is, you know, truly world class. I mean, 209 is world class, but 206 is a new level, and it's a huge personal record. So, massive congrats to Emile. But yeah, when you spell it out like that, and I'm obviously reading the board of what you've written out here, which you just spelled out, he's right. I mean, it is, Britain is not really very strong at the moment. And you could argue that the US is the same. It's just not very strong on the men's side. In fact, yeah, it's not even as strong as at least the front guy. They've got the 207 leaders. So yeah, many European countries have stronger teams. I mean, France, I didn't actually really pay attention to the fact that they have three guys at 205 and faster. That's pretty wild.
I didn't know that either. Yeah, that when I looked that up, I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know France was this good. That being said, it's kind of hard to draw the line between people who are not born in the country that they represent. But you can't really do that because overall, just across the board in probably every single country, there are people that are born outside of the country that end up representing the country. It's the same for the United States as well.
Exactly. I didn't really, yeah, that did enter my mind too when you read these out. Many of the faster times are African-born athletes, but yeah, that's a lost case in terms of debating because, yeah, every country has the same case, right? Australia's fastest 800-meter guys are not born in Australia. Yeah, there's many examples of that. But the women's only world record went down in a pretty tactical affair, it seemed like, or at least a pretty fast finish, which was good to see. Always good to see an actual good race. In marathon, there's not a lot of them. Oftentimes, it's just a pace race, and you're just watching a girl or a guy slowly grind their way to the end, and hopefully they might blow up or they might kick down. But this was actually a bit of an interesting finish. So, Yeah. Did you watch this one live? I didn't actually watch it live, but I've seen a couple of the replays.
I didn't watch it live either. I saw a replay. But it was interesting that Perez Cheer did outkick Tijus Assefa, who's obviously the world record holder, 211 woman, and actually a former 800 meter runner. That was the most interesting part to me, was that the foot speed that you have as an 800 meter runner compared to these marathoners and distance runners is a lot greater. And I thought that she was going to be able to pull away in the end, but it showed that she's vulnerable, and that just because you run 211 once in a paced race when you're with men the entire time doesn't mean that in a woman's only race, you're going to just be the automatic winner.
Yeah. Very well said. Very well said. You would assume that an 800 meter runner or 800 meter background would win in a sprint finish, but you know, I had to draw myself as a comparison, but I can say that once you turn to the marathon, your foot speed does fade away. So, but with that said, yeah, I think most people would have been, if people watching knew her background, they would have definitely backed her to outkick her in the finish just based on personal records. But, Jep Churcher took the win, and four women sub 217, which is pretty rare to see that sort of depth. I think we recapped last year, we spoke about the fact that there was, I think there was 10 or close to 10 women with personal records of sub 217.30 in this field, which is definitely the strongest marathon field that's ever been put together in the women's side. So, not super surprising, I guess, to see four women sub 217, even though it is a pretty incredible stat, but yeah, not super surprising. I thought what we did discuss last week, right, like what we thought might happen, and I thought the winning time might be a little bit quicker, but I did hear it was pretty windy out there. It was pretty good weather in the sense of the temperature and the, like, there was no sun exposure, but many friends of mine pointed out the fact that the wind was pretty brutal. So yeah, not super quick time. And that was reflected on the men's side too, with not a super quick winning time compared to what it normally is in London. But over back to the track, the Xiamen, I'm pretty sure I'm not saying that correctly, but I have been there in China. First Diamond League went down, men's 5K. What do you think about the results?
That was interesting to see. Lemecha Gurma, steeplechase world record holder, famous for finishing second behind El Bakkali in every single major championship since I can remember in the last 5 years. He wins the race in 12:58. I think the thing that stood out to me was apparently it was extremely hot in China during this race, and 12:58 was actually a really good time for the heat. Sam Parsons, German runner, Tin Man Elite guy, who a video was actually just posted on Sweat Elite Training Sessions YouTube channel with him. He was actually taken to the hospital after this race because his body just shut down from the heat. Luckily, he's fine. He's completely okay. He's actually racing the Shanghai Diamond League this weekend. But that, just to give people a thought of how hot it was, like Sam Parsons, who probably does a sauna multiple times a week to get ready to prep for this event, he even couldn't handle the heat, and it was crazy. But 12:58 for Gurma, he won over Nicholas Kipkorir, who was a Diamond League champion, I think, 2 years ago over 5,000 meters. So it's a really good result for him. He's just an overall, like, great runner. I think people, at least I, like, underestimate steeplechase runners as just being steeplechase runners, when in reality, they're pretty good over 1,500 meters and 3,000 meters. He's the Ethiopian record holder over 1,500 meters as well. So he shows good diversity there.
There's a funny picture on Sam Parsons' Instagram account of him in a hospital in China. Well, it's not funny, actually, but it isn't. He probably laughs at it now, but it looked pretty brutal. What else happened at the event at the Xiamen Diamond League?
I think just staying the 5,000 meters for a little bit longer, Stewie McSwain went 1305.1 or 0.3, which was just outside the Olympic standard of 1305 flat. And I'm sure he'll get it eventually. And even if he doesn't get it, he's competing in like every single Diamond League, so I'm sure he'll be in on points. But I think this was a very good showing of championship style racing versus time trial racing, and how different it is and how different it plays in different people's strengths. A couple of weeks ago, Matthew Ramsden finished first, got the gold medal in the Australian Championships over 5,000 meters. now coming to China in the Diamond League, where there's when Munir Akbache is taking them out in a pace job, perfectly paced with the lights and everyone's in a line. He finishes in dead last. Could something have happened? Yes, but I think just the difference between time trial racing and championship racing is always evident. And there's hundreds of pieces of evidence, and this is just another one of how it's just so different when there's a pacer and lights and everything set up for you to run fast versus when you're just competing with guys to see who can win.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very and it's partly physiological, but it's also very psychological. I think some people that get into races that they truly believe they can win, and it's a slow first few laps, it can be a very different headspace to jumping in a race where you know it's going to be strung out and it's going to be an absolute grind. And if you're sort of not really, especially if you just come off a win like he did in the Australian Nationals, I wouldn't be surprised if he went into that race being a little bit like, oh man, this is just like really going to hurt, like, especially in the heat. So I don't know Ramzan very well. I've only briefly spoken to him a couple of times, but yeah, hopefully he bounces back. And like you said, yeah, McSwain, I don't have too much doubt that he'll be able to hit that standard if he gets in the right race. But yeah, he's getting into most of the Diamond Leagues now, so the points will probably take care of themselves there. We're in the 1500. We saw a super quick time, 350 by Tsegay. Good eye, Tsegay. Third fastest time ever, which is an interesting way to start the season. I mean, I don't think anyone saw that coming, especially this early. But yeah, bit of a concern for Faith Kipyegon potentially to have this Heim posted so early in the season, especially in conditions that weren't ideal. So be interesting to see how she progresses through the year as well. But am I right in saying the Ethiopians were first to fifth in this race?
You are right. It was pretty crazy to see first through fifth. Many, many women going under 4 minutes. I mean, just going back to Faith Kipyegon for a second, I mean, there were rumors circulating around that Kipyegon was in this race, was entered into this race up until a couple weeks or days before the race. And it's rumored that Udof Tsegay knew she was in good shape and told the pacer that she wants to run quick, like around 350, go through like 1100 meters in like 249, 250, try and close in 60 seconds. And Faith Kipyegon is not there yet in her training and decided to just say, like, I'm out of this race. I don't want to get smoked by all these women.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, yeah, I would have expected her to be there, but who knows? You never know when little things like niggles and sickness and stuff, we have no idea about Kipyegon, obviously. But yeah, I'd believe that. There was also a pretty quick 800 meters, but in the men's with Arop going 143. And yeah, season, there was a few pretty fast season opening times here, especially in conditions that were subpar. But yeah, Clayton Murphy was in there as well, 145. Yeah. You know, not a bad result, not a great result. You know, having run quite a bit quicker than that in a really strong field, he probably isn't super stoked. But what else do you think about the men's 800?
I mean, personally, just running the 800, I love it when it's hot. Like, I want it to be like 85 degrees Fahrenheit. And like, I want the sun beating down because I want my muscles to be really, really loose. And you're only out there for less than 2 minutes. So it doesn't really affect you aerobically that much. But Arop, Marco Arop, one, continuing on his really strong effort from last year's World Championship where he won. I think the standout performer, though, was Masalela from Botswana, continuing on the Botswana 800-meter tradition of running fast at a young age. He ran a 1:43 personal best. He shocked people last year at the World Championships, where I'm pretty sure he made the final but didn't do anything there. He's going to be someone to look out for this year at the Olympics. He has the Olympic standard. He'll be on that team. I think it was cool to see that the Kip Keino Classic in Kenya and the GMN Diamond League were on the same day, and the 800 meters were only a couple hours apart, and the first 800 meters was in China, and Marco Arop, Kenya Mall, and Masalela all ran 1:43. And in the Kip Keino Classic, Emmanuel Wanyoni, who's Kenyan sensation, who's really young as well. I'm pretty sure he got second at the World Championships last year. He definitely saw that result and said, whatever you can do, I can do better. And he also ran 1:43.5, and he took the world lead in Kenya at the Kip Keino Classic, which was pretty interesting to see. I mean, I have a question for you, Matt. Do you think in Kenya at altitude, the 800 meters is affected by the altitude at all, either positively or negatively? Because I know in the sprints, it's positively affected because you're able to run through the air quicker at a faster speed. And then obviously at altitude, distance races are slowed down. But at the 800, it's kind of like the middle ground. Like, where do you see that?
My first and honest answer is I'm not sure, but my gut feel would say 400 meters is probably around the point that it would start to become a little bit hindered. So I think, and I have no idea, like I'm not the right person to ask this, but it is a good question. But let's face it, we don't typically see 142s coming out of Kenya, where, and there is a lot of guys that can run 142 from Kenya. Well, not a lot, but there's a couple, there's a few. We don't even really often see 143s in Kenya. So I think that might tell us enough that it's probably not, I mean, you know, it's classically known that 800 meters is roughly 50% aerobic, 50% anaerobic. You know, using my very little understanding of physiology, I believe that this would make the situation harder at higher altitude, given that it's 50% aerobic. That might be completely nonsense, what I just said, but I think that's the case. So given that Nairobi is at around 1,900 meters elevation, which is close to 7,000 feet, so 6,500 feet from what I understand, give or take a few hundred feet there. I think at that elevation, it's probably harder to run 800 meters. Yeah. If we're talking about Boulder, maybe not, but Nairobi's a bit higher.
Kind of makes sense. I mean, 143 world lead, Emmanuel Wanyoni, he called his shot this year saying that he wants to run 141 and that he's in the shape to run 141 by the end of the year. So hopefully we'll see some fireworks in the 800 meters, hopefully at the Olympic Games, because Rudisha set his world record at the Olympic Games. There's been a lot of fast 800 meter races. So hopefully there's some guy that won't win the race, but that will go out in a 49 and A-Rop and Wanyoni go with him. And we just see some fireworks over the last like 300 meters.
Yeah. Isn't it crazy to think how fast that world record is? 140 compared to like the times that coming out of Diamond Leagues now, like 143 here is considered fast. Many years, the fastest time in the world is 142 high. 2 seconds faster is the world record. And over 800 meters, that's 14 meters, 15 meters. Like it's, yeah, that is a really hard world record to take down. But if Wanyoni is already calling his shots to say he wants to run 141, you know, that's interesting. And if he's running 143 world lead this early on at altitude, yeah, we'll see what he's got. Hopefully he can get ready for the Olympics and make it happen in Paris.
Agreed. I think it's time to move on to our only preview of the episode, Shanghai Diamond League this weekend. There are 3 distance events, and they're actually all repeats of the Xiamen Diamond League. There's a women's steeplechase, men's 800, and the men's 5K. We're starting out with the women's steeplechase. Emma Coburn returns to Diamond League. She was the Olympic bronze medalist, and she will look to be taken down by the strong East African contingent of the Chepkoeches, Beatrice and Jacqueline. Beatrice, the world record holder from Kenya, and Sembo Almayu and Peruth Chemutai from Ethiopia and Uganda, respectively. I mean, I assume it's going to be hot again in Shanghai, so I wouldn't expect too quick of a time out of the steeplechase, but it's always good to see Emma Coburn return. I think she won something like 10 straight U.S. steeplechase titles at one point, so It'll be good for her to return back to form after losing out in the heats last year in Budapest.
We're going to see Emma Coburn return to the track. Hopefully she can, yeah, return to some form that she saw at the Olympics when she ran bronze, at least this year. You know, from everything I've understood about her training in Boulder, it sounds like she's, you know, well on track for trying to get back to that place, and obviously plenty of competition in the way as well. Yeah, looking forward to watching the Shanghai Diamond League. Men's 800 meters is looking to be pretty strong once again, but Arop is not going to be there from what I understand. Is that right?
Arop is not going to be there. I guess it was a quick trip to China for him rather than a lot of the other people that are in the GMN Diamond Leagues just decided to stay for the entire week and just do the doubleheader in China and stay in and go to Shanghai for next weekend. Clayton Murphy's in it again. Kenya Mall's in it again. Masa Leila's in it again. Except, I guess, notably, the Algerian duo, who have been getting more and more famous in the 800-meter game, Jamel Sajadi and Slimani Mula, will be in this race. Those guys usually race well and race hard, so that'll be interesting to see how they mix it up with Kenya Mamasalela and Alex Ngedich out of Kenya.
Men's 5K, also pretty exciting one to watch. Solomon Barriga in the 5,000 meters is the headliner. And Mike Foppen, who has been on the Svetlite podcast and on the Svetlite YouTube channel, will be there as well. Be good to see how he goes. And Australian Morgan McDonald is looking to get the Olympic standard there in Shanghai, the 13:05. Oh, man. Even though this is just continuously repeated, it's like these automatic standards are so hard nowadays. Like, I know the situation that it's predominantly points, you know, or it's heavy points now, but 13:05 is just, there's just not that many, at least outside of Africa, there's just not that many people every year that do that. But it applies to every distance, right? Like the 10K, you could argue, is even harder. Just so few people go under 27 minutes every year. Let's see how it goes.
Great. I think it'll be a good one as well. Morgan McDonald was hurt for a while last year. So interesting to see how he bounced back. I think he got second at the Aussie Nationals as well in the 5,000 meters. So it'll be good to see how he goes in a time trial race where most of his teammates will actually be in America at the Penn Relays. But I guess it's easier to go from Australia to China than it is from Australia to Philadelphia. So it'll be easy travel for him than it will be for someone like Ollie Hoare.
Thanks, everyone, for listening in to the action that was last week. There's obviously plenty more coming, especially from end of May, June onwards, when the track and field season really starts to heat up. That's when the roads sort of start to cool off for a little while. There's not too many marathons that take place after that, at least big ones. That sort of resumes after the summer. But these action weeks will be packed full of action, especially from sort of the end of next month. But plenty coming up. Appreciate you joining, Alex, and we'll speak to you all next week.